You're tuned to WUNH Durham.
My name is Craig McMurray, and this is Human Dimension. We're broadcasting from the 1925 room of the Elliott Alumni Center, and here with us this evening is Dr. David Van Nuys, visiting professor from California State University in Sonoma, California. He's currently teaching a class on campus here at the University of New Hampshire, a very popular one, in fact, on dreams. And this evening's topic of discussion is on dreams. And maybe you'd like to have some opening statements, Dave, on this topic this evening.
Okay. It's been been a treat for me to have the opportunity to teach this class here in New England. I think in California, this sort of thing is very current, and there are lots of people who are involved in tracking their dreams and involved in meditation and all kinds of far-out things like that. And here I find that there's a real hunger among students for a personal dimension in their classes. And it's been very exciting for me to be able to address people where they live. My training is as a psychotherapist, as a psychologist and psychotherapist, and often I feel that the best education tends to be therapeutic, and the best therapy tends to be educational. Carlos Castaneda, in his Don Juan books, which lots of us have read and been excited about, emphasizes the importance of following the path that has heart. And this has been an issue for me as a teacher to find out, what is it that I want to teach? What is it that I have to teach that has heart for me, that isn't just a regurgitation of dead facts or things that end up being more or less meaningless? And I find that dreams, that talking about dreams and helping students to understand the language of their own dreams, for me, is a path with heart. It has a kind of personal texture. It has the texture of people's lives and hopes and aspirations and fears. And it provides a perfect kind of forum. Part of this class, what we do is we spend one session out of the two sessions that we have each week in what we call dream groups, where students get together and they keep dream journals. And we share our dreams with each other. And it turns out that this is a very nice vehicle for communication, if nothing else. You know, it's like, what do you say to somebody after you've said hello? Or after you've said, my name is, and my major is, and what's your major? You know, that's an issue for all of us. How do we get beyond first base in a relationship? Dreams, the sharing of dreams, turns out to be a wonderful vehicle for doing that, because in kinds of indirect sorts of ways, you're talking about the very deepest aspects of yourself. And so that's what I've been doing, and I'm here ready to receive questions and give some answers.
Okay, thanks. If you just joined us, we're here in the 1925 room of the Elliott Alumni Center with Dr. David Van Nuys. He's going to be answering some questions from a live audience on the topic of dreams. We have some opening questions here from our audience. Okay, thank you.
Dave, just so I can get a little bit into what you were saying, you used the term the language of dreams. Can you share with us a little bit what you mean by that? Is there a language, or is there a commonality among dreams, or when you're trying to express or develop or evaluate a dream?
That's a good question. That gives me just the kind of springboard that I need. I think that there are two languages. There's our daytime language and our nighttime language. And Freud made this distinction when he talked about something called primary process thinking and secondary process thinking. And I think that he was accurate in that distinction that he observed, and that our dreams happen in maybe what we could call primary process thinking, or in terms of what some recent research seems to suggest is right hemispheric thinking, that dreams have a language of their own that is learnable and is understandable. A lot of people feel like, well, you have to, that's very mysterious, and the dreams are hiding something from you, and that their intent is to hide something from you. And this is was really at the core of Freud's theory, that we couldn't really face what our dreams had to say to us, and so that there was a process of censorship going on, distorting the dreams. I've moved away from that view myself and have been more influenced by the thinking of Carl Jung, who suggests that rather than trying to hide something, the dream seeks to reveal, but that it does it in its own unique, special language. And so you might ask, well, what is the language of dreams? And I would say the language of dreams tends to be the language of the heart, as opposed to the language of the head. In the daytime, we were used to negotiating in terms of the language of the head. I think dreams are mostly about feelings, and they're mostly pictorial. So if you want to understand a dream, the way to approach it is to approach it in the same way that you would approach a museum of art. If you were to go down to Boston to an art museum and try to be receptive to the pictures that you saw there. Probably the best way to do that is not in a super linear fashion to figure out this picture means exactly this or that, but to kind of just open up and let yourself kind of associate to the feelings that you get from it. Does that begin to answer your question?
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Do we have some more questions here on dreams? Okay, thank you.
David, you've alluded to a couple of the major approaches, Freud and Jung, and I wonder if you'd elaborate just a little bit more. What are some of the major ways in which dreams are and have been understood? And I'd also be interested to fit yourself into this.
That's a big one, yeah. And I'll see if I can just hit the highlights. I think since the beginning of time, people have wondered about dreams and have been struck by the phenomenon and have seen it as something tremendously significant. And the ancient theories of dreaming and the primitive theories of dreaming mostly seem to follow the pattern of some form of soul travel. It's seen that somehow your soul or your essence or something leaves the body, either within this earthly realm is able to travel off and see events in distant places, or perhaps enters into some other dimension or some other realm. And this sort of theory is still very current among many people who are involved in various kinds of metaphysical belief systems and so on. Many of them subscribe to this particular view. I think the first major modern theory is Freud's, which I alluded to, and I assume that everybody's reasonably familiar with that. It was his feeling that all human behavior can essentially be reduced to two basic motives, sexuality and aggression. And he felt that due to our acculturation that we couldn't face up to all the implications of our earliest and most primitive thoughts, and so that we disguise these nursery terrors in our dreams, and that each dream represents wish fulfillment, but a wish that's been disguised. Later, Jung comes along, Carl Jung, the Swiss psychoanalyst, and he really departed from Freud's heavy emphasis on sexuality. And it was Jung's feeling that the human personality is something much larger than that bit of ourselves that we consciously identify with, which he would call our ego. So when I say, I like this, I don't like that, that's what I'm consciously aware of. but that there's that's only a part of the whole, and he was interested in a holistic view. This has become a pretty current word, holistic. It's a popular word now. And it was his feeling that the dream compensates for the narrow, limited attitudes of the conscious day, and that the dream is like a voice from the whole and represents the whole. And so the dream serves as a kind of guide, as an inner therapist, to direct you towards your true center, your true feelings. A more recent theory is, and a very popular one, is one propounded by Fritz Perls, founder of Gestalt therapy. And, excuse me, his view is also very productive. He sees, he looks at the dream and he says, you're every character in your dream, you're every aspect of that dream is somehow a projection of some aspect of yourself. So when I have a dream in which I'm being chased by some terrible monster down the road, well, let me not give a hypothetical example, but use one of my own dreams that I just had. Sometimes you have a really scary dream that just kind of grabs you, shakes you. And this dream literally did that. I was going in my dream, it was dark, and I was going downstairs, and I wanted to turn on the lights, so I reached in through the bathroom door to switch on to flip on the switch. And as I did that, somebody or something lunged against the bathroom door, slamming it on my arm and snarling. And it startled me, so it was like a murderous kind of... It startled me, and I was jolted into being awake immediately. Now, according to the Gestalt view, well, let me just back up a second. As I relate the dream, I say, I went downstairs, and I reached in to turn on the light, and this awful, murderous creature scared me. There was a murderer there trying to get me. In the Gestalt view, the part of me where I'm saying, I went downstairs, that's the part that I can identify and readily recognize as myself. But I also have to recognize that I am the force behind the door. That's a part of me too. I created the dream. The whole thing is my fantasy, my projection. So I am as much the murderer as the victim. I'm also the door, and I'm also the light switch. And Fritz Perls found it very productive to get people into doing an inner dialogue in which they would actually act out these various roles. And so if I say, I am the white switch, and immediately I begin to get certain ideas about I can, in fact, illuminate some of the dark areas in my soul and in my personality if I choose to. And likewise, if I say, I am this terrible force behind the door, I can perhaps begin to get in touch with less than noble, aggressive impulses that I might have. So that's another major theory. Let me just hit two more quickly. A lot of people have been interested in a tribal group often somewhere in Burma known as the Sonoy. And the Sonoy made the conscious control of dreaming an important facet of their communal life. They share their dreams, they build communal rituals out of their dream lives, and they instruct their children on how to respond to dreams. And my Sonoy father, if I were a child, would tell me, the next time you have that dream, when you go into the bathroom and this force is trying to slam the door on you, you must confront it. And you must learn to look it in the eye and have power over it, because you can have power over it, and get it to teach you its song or its dance and turn it into an ally. I think you can see the underlying psychological wisdom of that approach. There's a kind of profound message there that says you can master your inner world. A lot of people in the West have begun to work on this idea of being lucid in a dream, what's called a lucid dreaming, retaining some awareness and beginning to move about in the dream space rather than just being a victim. And as I've proposed this idea to students here on campus, I'm amazed to see about half to three quarters of the students end up having a lucid dream sometime during the course of the semester. I ask students to try out a task that Castaneda proposes in one of his Don Juan books, where Don Juan tells, who is, in case some of you aren't familiar with this, it describes an American Indian, what's the right word, shaman, witch doctor, we call them witch doctors, what do we call them? Medicine man, right, what we would think of as a medicine man. And he's sharing secret teachings with a young anthropology student, and he tells him, look at your hands in a dream. And he tells him this not because there's any inherent value in looking at one's hands, but because it's kind of the kindergarten of lucid dreaming, to give him an assignment to remember to do something in a dream. So I share this with my students, and I say, why don't you try remembering to see your hands? And I have to share this with you. One girl had a dream where she was in the midst of a nightmare, and she was being pursued. And she picks, and somewhere in the course of the dream, she's reading a newspaper. And the headline on the newspaper says, Girl Remembers to Look at Hands. And in the course of that, then of course she noticed that in fact her hands were holding the newspaper. And at that point, the dream changed. She didn't come out of the dream, but suddenly she had power within the dream, and she was no longer a victim. And she was able to turn that around. The one other theory that I would mention in this rather long-winded response to your question would be psychic theories of dreaming. Some of us, and I'm one, are convinced that sometimes there seems to be a kind of ESP aspect to dreams. The dreams seem to see around the corner. None of us really understand what this universe is ultimately composed of. As I understand it, many physicists are speculating that consciousness is somehow at the root, or that consciousness, matter, energy are somehow interchangeable. Time we recognize as an artifact of kind of the way we're wired up. Dreams somehow seem often to transcend time. And lots of people have dreams about things that happen the next day. And lots of people have dreams about things that happen to loved ones in faraway places. I think I should stop that answer and move on to the next question.
Hey, if you just joined us, we're in the 1925 room of the Elliott Alumni Center with Dr. David Van Nuys, who is answering questions from a live audience on the topic of dreams. Do we have some more questions here from our audience? Thank you.
In order to work with our dreams, we would have to remember our dreams. Are there some basic steps in remembering dreams?
Right. Okay, good. This is a tricky one. Dreams are very slippery for most of us. They're like smoke. And you know how smoke can just slip through your fingers and pretty soon disappears. Unless maybe you take a picture of it or catch it in a glass or something. There may be some ways that you can capture smoke. Dreams are much like that. If you don't capture them right away, you'll forget them. So the first piece of advice is try to write down the dream immediately upon awakening. I brought my own dream journal with me just to be able to show you one. This is one of those books of bound but blank pages that you can buy, and I like to use that. It doesn't matter what you use. People who are really dedicated about this sort of thing, some few individuals have learned to write in the dark. They don't even switch on the light, and they just write during the middle of the night. They just reach over half asleep and they start writing down their dreams. Patricia Garfield, who wrote a book called Creative Dreaming, has logged 10,000 of her own dreams in this fashion. And she reports that some of her dreams, while she's writing, she lapses into sleep and then comes out and starts writing again. Most of us don't have that degree of dedication. If you're having trouble remembering your dreams, something that often works is, as you're falling asleep the night before, to kind of repeat to yourself over and over again, in the morning I will remember a dream. I like to say a significant dream. Of course, they're all significant, but some dreams are little dreams and some dreams are big dreams. Primitives make this distinction of a great dream. And every now and then you have something that you recognize as a great dream. So writing them down is good, and kind of priming yourself ahead of time is good, and taking them seriously is good. If you tend to treat your inner life as trivial and all of your energy is focused on the objective and the externals, as our culture tends to reinforce, then it's to be expected that your subconscious mind isn't going to offer you much. If you begin to value it, take it seriously, tell people your dreams, read books about dreaming, come to lectures on dreams, you'll notice that something inside gets stimulated and seems to respond. I wouldn't be surprised if you had a dream tonight. Hypnosis is another good method.
Okay, there's more questions here on the topic of dreams. Thanks.
Once you've passed the first step of getting your dream down in a journal, I'm curious, how do you work with it? Let's say it's something that's bothered you, or maybe it's something that hasn't bothered you, but just you've gotten some kind of enlightenment out of it and made you feel good. How do you get some more out of it?
Okay. I think most people feel like you have to have some special kind of training in order to understand dreams, that you have to have gone through years of psychoanalysis, or you have to read special books so that you'll know that this symbol means that. That's hogwash. The training that you do need is what has been described as listening with the third ear, learning to use your intuition. To make that more concrete for you, though, the thing that I find most useful is to look at the dream as a metaphor for feelings and thoughts and things that are going on in my real, actual life. I think the place to start out is not to get too spacey with it and too far out and too mystical, but the dreams are really about the things that are going on in your life. And it takes just a little while to orient students towards this. They'll tell a dream, and I say, well, what do you think it means? And they say, I don't know. and it's just totally opaque to them. But I'll have some hints right away. I mean, maybe there's something going on about there's a girl in the dream, and it's a guy who's had the dream, and so I'll start saying, well, tell me about your relationship with women. Do you have a girlfriend? Get them to start talking about the events of their life and the events of the day and what their concerns and what are the issues that they're chewing on. And if you just be metaphoric about it, if you approach it like you would poetry, the correspondences just begin to hit you in the face. And it's important to realize that everybody has their own symbol system. So I think it's wrong for me to say, oh, you dream about water, that means X. Water may mean one thing to you and a different thing to me. Does that help at all? And I could be, you know, if we had time to work on some actual dreams, then I could show you more what I mean.
Okay, our next question, please.
Right. Interesting. But what about us animals that don't dream?
Well, we all dream.
Remember then, perhaps.
Yeah, that's what's at stake, is whether we remember them or not. Because I guess it's been about 15, 20 years now since some researchers, I think, at the University of Chicago, it was a graduate student who first made this, you know, one of these revolutionary observations that was available to all of us, to all humankind, as long as we've been around. People's eyes roll around in their heads while they're dreaming. And you've seen that. You've observed that in people, probably, and you've observed it in animals. Your dog, you see the little paws running, the eyes rolling around in the head. And we say, he's having a dream. We say, isn't that cute? He's having a dream. So with all the modern electrophysiological monitoring devices, they've been able to figure out that pretty much what we think of as a dream happens when our eyeballs are rolling around. And it turns out that we all seem to dream every night. So what's at stake is dream recall. It's my feeling, and I don't have any hard evidence for this, but that people who are very sort of outgoing, extroverted, pragmatic, practical, and so on, will be less likely to remember their dreams than people who are involved in their inner life, who are interested in things like the kind of person who, when they read a book, just becomes totally lost and loses track of space and time. This is a kind of very inner-directed person, a person who's very introspective, a person who's maybe inclined to keep a journal anyway. I think that kind of person's more likely to remember their dreams. I did a little piece of research trying to answer this question for myself. Why is it some people remember their dreams and some don't? Because I'm always asked this question. And I thought it might relate to the right and left hemispheres. And there's a whole bunch of interesting research on when you ask a person a question, when you're looking them right in the eye, often their eyes will shift either to the right or the left. And it turns out that these eye shifts seem to relate to which hemisphere of the brain is dominant. So that people whose eyes shift to their left, when you ask them a question like, how many letters are in George Washington? Most people kind of move their eyes, right? If my eyes move left, it seems that there's some evidence that what's happening is I'm accessing the right hemisphere. Now, the right hemisphere in most people seems to be the place where creative, intuitive thought happens, since the speech center is on the left. So most logical, deductive, word-oriented thought seems to happen in the left hemisphere. So I predicted that people who remember their dreams would tend to be left lookers, that is, right hemisphere dominant people. And it turned out for men that that was so in two studies that I've done. Women, it turns out, are much more complex in the way that their brains are organized. And not only in my study, but in a whole bunch of other studies, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that men are highly lateralized. They specialize in which hemisphere they're going to use for what, and that women are more flexible and move back and forth a lot more, or seem to use both sides equally. So I haven't checked this out, but I suspect women tend to remember their dreams more than men.
What can a parent do for a child that has a recurring nightmare, and some of the special problems that that brings, not only for the child, but maybe just for parents getting a good night's sleep? Could you talk about that a little
bit? Well, that's a good question. If I weren't a parent myself, I could be more hypocritical about it and just give you some glib answer. I've tried some of these techniques on my own children. You know, I've tried to be a Sonoy parent, and I go in and say to my little girl, "Well, just look that monster in the eye, and and he'll go away." And she says, "Oh, Daddy." So you can't always import these things out of context. There seems to be something maturational and neurological about children having nightmares. The brain is still in the process of myelination and development in those early years. And it's suspected that this has something to do with childhood nightmares. They seem to be pretty normal. You know, there's certain years, they're around 4, 5, and 6, I would say, seem to be intense nightmare years. And I can still remember a couple of my childhood nightmares. So I think the best that you can do is to be reassuring, comforting, and so on.
Assuming that this maturational process is consistent among all children, then there must be some common themes that occur for a young child in the dreams that they have.
Monsters. Monsters. The dream portrays our existential situation, and that's a 25-cent word. I guess what I mean is how it is for us, what exists in our life. And what exists for a child is that he or she is a relatively small, powerless person in a land of giants. So maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that their nightmares are peopled by giants who are stronger and more powerful than they are, and that they feel overwhelmed, you know, by forces that they can't master.
So we're here in the 1925 room at the Elliott Alumni Center with Dr. David Van Nuys, who's answering questions from a live audience on the topic of dreams. Do we have some more questions here from our audience? Okay, thank you.
I was just wondering which theoretical approaches you found most useful in an interpretation of dreams.
I'm pretty eclectic, and I just hop around between the various ones as they seem to suit the situation best. Sometimes a dream seems truly Freudian, and it's just smacking you right there in the face, you know, and a phallic symbol really looks like a phallic symbol, and it seems like that's what it's about. At other times, a Jungian kind of orientation seems to make sense. I think most of the time, I'm guided by what I would consider to be just a kind of common sense intuitive approach, which, as I say, I tend to look at the dream as a metaphor for what's going on in the person's life. And that seems to be good for a lot of mileage.
Okay,
just to do that. Somebody had a dream in which they were in a zoo, as if they were an animal, and people were throwing peanuts to them. And this fits this person's situation rather well, when we were able to discuss about that, you know. This fits you, doesn't it, that in some way you settle for peanuts in your relationships with people, and that you're willing to perform to get just the slightest little bits of praise, you see? And that's, I don't know that I relate that to any particular theory. It's just there as a kind of poetic metaphor.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Some more questions.
Do you feel that dreams have both a latent and a manifest meaning? Can a dream say something in a very obvious way and yet be about something else? Or should we take our dreams at a face value as we understand them? Are we incorrect in doing that?
I think that a dream... Some people have suggested that dreams don't have any meaning. We're just reading all of this in there. The Hasidic view of dreams is something like that. Maybe that's true. I don't know. I tend to look at the dream as a gym. as a many-faceted diamond. You know, if you hold a diamond up to the light, if you hold it up just so, you get blue. And then if you rotate it a little, you get red. And if you rotate it again, some other color fire flashes at you. And the dream seems to be like that. It's a very complex thing, and it can be addressed at many different levels. So I think we never fully exhaust the meaning of a dream. And I think there are surface kinds of meanings that we can see for ourselves. There are other kinds of meanings that go deeper than that, that we're unlikely to see without the guidance of someone else. Just as there are many facets of our character and our behavior that we're unlikely to see because we're blind to it. Somebody else can see it more clearly than we can. So that's why sometimes it's helpful to have a guide or somebody else who's working with you on the process. But I don't think it's that one is wrong and one is right. And that's not to say that there are no wrong interpretations. An interpretation is wrong. If I interpret your dream or give you some of my ideas about your dream, it's wrong. I regard it as wrong. If you don't somehow have an intuitive sense of a fit, if I don't get a bit of an aha response from you, then I give up on that line and I look for another, I try to pursue it from another direction. And I'm very tenacious. I find that in my classes, students give up too soon. And so if they would process 15 dreams in a session, but when I'm there, we're lucky if we get through one or two or three, because I just keep digging and keep digging for all the angles and just really try to milk it, you know, of all the meaning I can get out of it.
Okay, do we have some more questions here from our listening audience? Thank you.
Several people in the past have reported prophetic dreams, which have come true. And I wonder if there is any information about those.
Let's see. Prophetic dreams, of course, are, the Bible is full of prophetic dreams. A whole set of books are written by what we call the prophets in the Old Testament. And then the birth of Christ is heralded in Isaiah and is heralded to Joseph in a dream, I believe. And an angel is said to appear to Mary, and we don't know if that's meant as a vision, as a kind of metaphor for a vision or a dream, or whether it's meant to be taken literally. More recently, a friend of mine has written a book called Patterns of Prophecy, in which he has examined modern dreams and modern prophecies, and as well as ancient ones, and feels that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that dreams do foretell the future. Louisa Rhine, the wife of J.B. Rhine, who is the eminent parapsychology researcher at Duke University, she set out to collect spontaneous anecdotes of ESP as it just occurred in people's lives, and she ran ads and papers around the country saying, if you've ever had any kind of ESP happening, I'd be interested in hearing about it. And so she collected 7,000 cases, which she documents in a book, which I believe the title of it is The Hidden Channels of the Mind by Louisa Rhine. And about two-thirds of these spontaneous ESP events happen during sleep, in the dream state. Many of them are accounts where a mother dreams of a son who's killed in battle, or who's in an automobile accident, or something like that. And it happens, and it turns out that later when she's able to compare the time and the date, that there's a correspondence. And whenever I talk like this, people come forth and say that they've had an experience of their own that fits that pattern. Another friend of mine is an eminent researcher into psychic phenomena, Stanley Krippner, who worked in a laboratory at Maimonides Hospital in New York. And he did some studies, some carefully controlled studies, to look into the question of whether dreams could predict future events. And what he did was he wired up dreamers to all this electrical monitoring equipment so that they could tell when the person was dreaming. And they recorded a night's dreams. And they had determined that some predetermined but secret set of events was going to happen to this person the next day. For instance, they had a collection of envelopes, and each envelope described a possible scenario. And then the next day, one of those envelopes would be chosen at random. And let's say the scenario describes that this fellow will wear a parka while looking at a picture of an Eskimo and have ice water poured over his head with a cold fan blowing on him, all to augment this kind of North Pole experience. The independent judges then compare his dreams of the preceding night and look to see if there were any images or whatever that would predict what had happened the next day. This is kind of complicated. Do you follow the way I'm telling it? What they would do is they would give the judges 10 possible scenarios, one of which was the real one, and they give them the transcripts of the night's dreams and say, let's see if you can match which actual scenario was chosen and happened the following day based on the dreams of the preceding night. And well beyond chance, since this is the probabilities are exact and determinable, that a judge would supposedly have a 10% chance of making a correct match if he were given 10 scenarios. And judges were able to do these matches against odds of millions to one. This research is described in detail in a book that's widely available called Dream Telepathy by Stanley Krippner. I'm convinced. I've had a few minor dreams of my own that seemed prophetic of something that happened the next day. Do I have time to tell my dream or not? Okay. Some of you here may have far more startling prophetic dreams than this example that I'll give, but believe it or not, as tender-minded as I may sound here, I'm something of a skeptic, and it's hard for me to accept experiences that I haven't had myself. And I had a dream in which I encountered a friend, and he looked somehow strange and different to me. I recognized him as a friend of mine, but there was something different. And I said, Barry, did you get a haircut? You look different. And he said, why, yes, I did. I said, that's not it. You had a beard, didn't you? Did you shave? And he said, yes, I did. I said, no, that's still not it. And I said, I know, you've had a head transplant, haven't you? And he said, why, yes, I did. And then later on in the dream, I began to undergo a head transplant. It felt rather nice. This was such a striking dream to me. And this is what I like about this story. I told my wife about it when I woke up the next morning. It was so unusual. I said, you know, I had this dream about Barry, and he had a head transplant. And she said, that's funny. When I got to work that day, I discovered quite by surprise that there was a book in my mailbox that had been sent to me unsolicited, unexpected, from a publisher. I had been sent a book to review. And the name of the book was The Brain Revolution. And as I opened the first page and looked at it, it said, things are moving so fast in this field that people are beginning to speculate about the possibility of head transplants. Now, you know, one could say, well, that's a coincidence. Well, it sure is. It was a convincing one to me, because I had never thought about head transplants. It seemed like a kind of bizarre thought to me, and that it should crop up like that. Just, and then I should have said someone, because usually somebody would say, well, maybe you thought you had a dream about head transplants, but I got a witness.
I will have some more questions here, but perhaps you might encourage the audience, Dave, if they'd like to share a dream. Maybe we could.
Oh, I'd like to do that.
We could
sure.
go through some steps.
If you have a dream that you'd like to share with millions of listeners, do you have millions of listeners? It helps if it's a fresh dream. I'd like to add too. It's harder to go very far with a dream that you had a year ago or 2 years ago because your associations aren't too fresh. If it's a major dream, though, sometimes you can do something with it.
Okay, thank you.
What about recurring dreams? That's the question. The answer is, recurring dreams, I think, are like a message that somehow is really trying to get through to you and is asking for your attention. You know, and it's like if you don't answer the telephone, then it's going to keep ringing and they're going to call back. But once you answer the telephone and get the message, then they'll leave you alone. And I think there are two kinds of recurring dreams. One is one that has its roots in early childhood and or in some kind of early childhood trauma, or maybe some subsequent trauma, people who've been in an accident or people who've been in the war have suffered what's known as battle neuroses or battle shock, and often will experience a recurring dream. And this seems to be an attempt by the ego to work through and to somehow get a hold of a situation where they were completely overwhelmed. If that can be dealt with early enough, if you know somebody who's had an accident or been through some trauma and is starting to have these dreams, send them to me or send them to a shrink somewhere. If you nip it in the bud, those dreams can be ended. If somebody's suffering from battle fatigue type dreams for 20 years, they're very difficult to eradicate. These are relatively rare. Most recurring dreams, I think, are of a more psychological order, where there is some kind of existential message, as I say, that's not being attended to.
Okay, thank you.
Often when I dream, I see colors, and the color that hits me the most is red. I see red in fire and red in fruit a lot. Sometimes that's the only color I remember. Also, I'm aware of smelling things in dreams. Is this unusual or particularly significant?
Lots of people dream in color. I think probably most people aren't particularly aware of the color dimension one way or the other. You say, do you dream in color? And I guess so. I don't know. Some people report it very explicitly that they dream in black and white. And they're just very aware of dreaming in black and white. Not too many of those people. I think that I would tend to hypothesize in a rule of thumb kind of way that the black and white dreamer is somewhat abstracted from their inner life. Like there's a bit of remove for that person. I would say that for there are people who never have a sense of being in their dream. They're always a spectator watching something, but it's never really them in the dream. This is like maybe the photographic attitude towards life, you know. Sometimes people speculate that the photographer hides behind his camera. It's maybe a way of keeping distance from one's inner life. So I think the fact that you're in touch with color suggests just the opposite of that, a kind of closeness, a kind of vividness and receptivity to your own inner processes. The fact that you are aware of smells, again, suggests an expanded awareness. I would want you to speculate on maybe what red means for you. There are esoteric ideas about what red means, but rather than impose that on you, I'd just ask you, well, what comes to mind for you with red? What does it symbolize to you? You don't have to answer that, or you can.
Okay, we have time for a few more questions. Thank you.
There's a color therapist in San Francisco. I'm not sure if you've heard anything about it. But she's suggesting that different colors in dreams are different psychic experiences. Purple is astrological traveling. Red is digression into the past. You've heard about it?
Yes, I've heard about... I don't know if I've heard of her specifically, but I've heard about that sort of thing. And that's not my particular bent. I mean, I think that that can be fruitful, and it would be fruitful for somebody who's working within that particular belief system. Our dreams are malleable and seem to shape themselves to speak to us within the belief system that we're working within. So people have noted for a long time that people who go into Freudian analysis have nice Freudian dreams to offer their analysts. And people who go into Jungian analysis have nice Jungian-type dreams. And people who go into Gestalt therapy have nice top-dog, underdog-type dreams. And that doesn't invalidate the dreaming process, but rather it's like the dream is saying, oh, you want to talk Gestalt? Okay, I'll tell you in Gestalt. Okay, you want to talk metaphysics? I'll tell you in metaphysics. So my own approach is to avoid any kind of one-to-one, this means that kinds of interpretations. So that's why I would tend to avoid saying that purple means astral travel. That's just my particular bias.
Okay, Dave, one last question here.
I just want to report something, really. I'm an immigrant, and I can still... That's 24 years ago. I immigrated into this country with a different language, and I can still remember the day that I woke up and dreamt in English.
Your first English dream.
And I guess now that I know more, I can say, well, the acceleration was that I belonged, and I fitted in, and I felt more comfortable. But it took 3 years.
3 years. Yeah. Do you find yourself dreaming in your first language ever now?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Dave, do you want to have some closing remarks maybe on dreams? Something that you'd like to share with us here or our listening audience?
How much time do I have?
About 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Your dreams are your allies and friends, and they're worth courting and giving some time to and paying attention to, and it opens up a wonderful adventure and a journey, and adds another dimension of depth to the process of living, in my experience. So I invite you all to join in on this journey.
Thanks a lot, Dave. I've really enjoyed it this evening, and I'd like to thank the listening audience as well as our live audience for joining us here this evening.